Welcome to the National Civil War Centre and Newark Museum. This audio guide is intended to help you find your way around the galleries. I'll talk about some of the highlights in our museum, but I can't possibly describe everything that's here. So if you have any questions, please speak to the volunteer who will be delighted to help you. Begin your tour on floor one. This wheelchair belonged to Sir Thomas Fairfax, a renowned general in the Parliamentarian Army. Fighting in the Civil War, he was wounded in the chest, shoulder, leg, wrist, and head. In his 40s and 50s, his various wounds came back to trouble him, and he used this wheelchair throughout his later years. It is a tall frame. When you're sitting in the wheelchair, you'd be much higher than you are standing now. The frame and wheels are made of wood, and the seat and the high back are padded leather, studded at the sides. On the arms of the wheelchair are revolving handles, enabling the wheelchair user to turn the chair or propel themselves forwards and backwards. This wheelchair has been loaned to us by kind permission of the Fairfax family, and you'll see some more of Fairfax's items upstairs. Step through the double doors into the Civil War Gallery and turn to the left. Above your head is the King's flag, and to your left is a large portrait of King Charles I, and next to it a portrait of his wife, Queen Henrietta Maria. The King raised his standard in Nottingham on the 22nd of August 1642, and the Civil War began. Both sides claimed to be fighting for the King, but they were fighting over the definition of monarchy. The Royalists fought to defend God's chosen ruler. Parliament said they wanted to rescue the King from his advisers and wanted a greater role in government. Charles I could not allow this because he believed he had a divine right to rule. In his portrait, King Charles I is recognisable by his long flowing dark hair and pointy goatee beard. He is sitting astride a large white charger, looking very powerful. He is wearing a full suit of armour called a cuirassier, minus the helmet, embellished with a white lace collar and a blue sash. Turning to your right and staying at the edge of the room, walk towards the nearest small case on your left. This case contains 5 gold coins. The coin on the left is a James I Unite, dating from 1615 or 1616. The Unite was worth 20 shillings or £1. On one side there is a shield, which symbolises uniting the 3 kingdoms of England, Scotland and Ireland, and on the other side James I is depicted more as a Roman emperor than an English king. The smallest coin, in the centre of the 5, is a gold touchpiece. Charles I believed that kings and queens were chosen by God and so were above the law. The king's divine power even meant that he could cure diseases. From the Middle Ages onwards, people believed that the king's touch could cure a skin disease called scrofula. Every year, thousands of people with this disease queued up to be cured by the king with a single touch. They were given a coin like this, with an angel on one side. The coin was touched by the king and then hung around the ill person's neck. The ceremony continued until the early 18th century, and this coin dates from the time of Queen Anne. Continuing in the same direction, the next small case in the wall contains 2 books. The second of these books is Lord Newark's speech to the trained bands. This speech was made by the Royalist Lord Newark shortly before the outbreak of war, in an attempt to rouse the spirits of local men. This is an extract from the speech.
Gentlemen and all my good countrymen, these noble gentlemen and I have, as directed by virtue of His Majesty's Commission of Array, called you together to acquaint you with the grounds and reasons of why we are here, which are the defence of His most sacred person, the King, as well as the defence of your liberty, laws, religion, and the just privileges of both Houses of Parliament. I hope, as also I am sure your Majesty most heartily wishes, that this is the furthest that you need to journey, and that you need not travel to other counties, but if an urgent or necessary occasion arises that requires you to travel further afield, I will accompany you, and ensure that none of you shall face any hazard that I will not face myself. Your troubles and dangers will also be mine, and we will share in any fortunes, and I shall care for every one of you as I would care for myself.
There are some costumes displayed to your left. Parliamentarians were nicknamed roundheads after the short haircuts worn by the London apprentices. They're often presented as wearing plain, dark clothes like Puritans. Royalists were nicknamed cavaliers from the Spanish word caballeros, horse-riding soldiers with a reputation for drinking. They're often presented with long hair and fancy bright clothes. For instance, in the far right-hand corner of the gallery, there is a portrait of Sir John Bellasyse, Royalist military governor of Newark, and he is presented wearing red silk clothes and very fancy lace. However, these stereotypes did not always ring true. Sir Thomas Fairfax led the Parliamentarian army, and he was a pretty snappy dresser. Behind you is a large low case containing a model of a sconce, a kind of fort often used for Civil War defences. They are based on a Dutch fort design brought over from Europe by engineer Bernard de Gomme. A sconce is a large four-pointed star-shaped earthwork. This model shows Royalist soldiers standing on top of the fort, defending Newark against the besieging Parliamentarian army using cannon. The cannon are pointing outwards from the fort. On all sides there are wooden palisades, spikes and ditches, with large holes dug in the ground, intended to prevent cannon or horses from getting through. We are very lucky in Newark to still be able to visit one of the last remaining sconces in this country. Why not visit Sconce Park after you leave the museum today? As well as enjoying a pleasant walk in the park, you can stand on top of the Queen's Sconce and imagine the besieging Parliamentarians and Scottish Presbyterians trying to find their way into town. Continue following the wall until you reach the corner. To your right, there is a large screen containing a database all about the sieges that happened across the UK. You can search on the map to find out if any sieges happened in your area. To your left, there is a large case that contains some household items from the 17th century. Something that interests me is the glass in the top left corner. It's not complete, as the top seems to have been broken off at some time. It's a pale green glass that has some decoration on the sides, like large raspberries. It's possible this design was intended to prevent the glass slipping through your hand when you were eating with your fingers. At the top of the case is a large earthenware watering can, and in the lowest right-hand corner, there is a Bellarmine jug. This bottle probably started its life as a German beer or wine bottle. On the neck of the bottle is a fierce bearded face. Bottles like this are nicknamed Bellarmine jugs after Cardinal Bellarmine, who was not a popular man in the 17th century. These bottles have been found everywhere, hidden in the houses of both rich and poor people. Instead of beer, they often contain bent pins, fingernails, heart-shaped pieces of fabric, human hair and urine. People used them to protect themselves from witchcraft at a time when almost everybody was superstitious. On floor 3, you'll find a green glass witch bottle, which was found here in this very building when builders were restoring our Tudor Hall. At the end of this gallery is our small cinema. This may be closed due to COVID restrictions. Pass the cinema to the case in the opposite corner. This contains battlefield surgery tools, such as a bullet extractor, bone saws, and muscle knives. These bullet extractors look like elongated corkscrews. If a person was shot and you needed to remove a bullet, the bullet extractor was placed in the wound and the screw at the end was inserted into the musket ball. Musket balls were made of lead and should be malleable in this way. Although we have a few of these screw-in bullet extractors in our collection, in fact it's more likely that most battlefield surgeons used goose-billed bullet extractors, which look more like a pair of scissors that would be inserted in the wound and then you could grab the bullet and pull it out. Civil War weapons inflicted terrible wounds. If these became infected, the wounded arm or leg had to be cut off. This was done in two moves with no pain relief, first with a muscle knife, and then using a bone saw to cut through the bone. Also in this case is a hand brand. This is shaped like a mitten. It is made of iron, designed to be put into the fire and heated. Within the shape of the hand, there are spikes, which would brand the hand. Spikes are made into the pattern C, with then a crown and an R, to stand for Charles Rex. Soldiers from both sides ran away. If they were caught, they were branded with the name of the army they were trying to escape from. Next to the medical case, there is a chair decorated in pink brocade silk. The chair has hinges so that it can be leaned back, and there is a hole in the seat. This is a very rare example of a 17th century birthing chair that must have belonged to a high status woman. And next to it is a low wooden cradle. The third siege of Newark lasted almost 6 months. It was a very hard time for the people of Newark, in which many people went hungry and disease was rife. However, life carried on. There were births, deaths and marriages, the same as any other time. In the next case, there is a selection of unusually shaped coins. These are siege pieces, emergency money minted in the town of their origin during a siege, when money was short. Newark siege pieces are made of silver and cut in a diamond shape. On one side, they say OBS, Newark, and a date. OBS is short for the Latin word for siege. Newark siege coins were all minted in 1645 or 1646. On the other side of the coin, there is a picture of a crown and the letters CR, again for Charles Rex, and the value of the coin. These were minted in Newark Castle. The coin at the top of the display is a siege piece from Scarborough. Continue along towards the end of the gallery. On your right, there is a very tall glass case which contains some weapons and armour. There is a cavalry breastplate in this case. You can tell it's a cavalry breastplate for a soldier fighting on horseback because the armour stops above the waist. It was intended to protect the chest, but to allow freedom of movement for the legs and hips. There is a dent in the armour, approximately over the area of the heart. This is unlikely to be damage sustained in battle. In fact, often armourers would test their armour in front of a customer in order to prove that the armour was shot-proof. This is called a proof mark. To the left of this breastplate and lower down, there is a cavalry helmet. This helmet has been damaged, probably in battle. It has many dents and a crack. Cavalry helmets usually had protection for the face and neck in order to protect the wearer against attack by sword. There are some flintlock pistols in this case, so named because of the piece of flint held in a clamp. When the gun trigger was pulled, the flint moves into place and strikes a piece of metal, which causes a spark, which lights the gunpowder, which causes the explosion, which shoots the bullet out of the gun. Muskets in our collection, on the other hand, use a match rather than a flint. These are called matchlock muskets. The match is a piece of rope which is kept constantly burning. A good musketeer in the Civil War could shoot twice every minute. On the end wall of the gallery is a portrait of Oliver Cromwell, painted in 1649, the year the king was executed. Cromwell is wearing shiny armour and there is a servant in the picture. He looks suspiciously like the portrait of the king that you saw on your way in. Cromwell famously refused to be crowned after Charles I was executed, but he did instead have the title Lord Protector, which he retained until his death. Leave this gallery now and make your way straight ahead until you reach the lift on your right-hand side. Go up in the lift to floor 2 and then exit to look at some cases of more armour. Floor 2 is only small, but I don't want you to miss the automaton, which represents King Charles I throwing his enemy into the pit of hell. The automaton is to your left at the top of the stairs. Wind the handle to see what happens. To its right, there are some more great examples of Civil War armour, including some siege armour on its own in a case. Siege armour was much thicker and heavier than the kind of armour usually worn in battles. It was intended to protect the wearer from explosives and falling masonry, the kind of injuries that might happen to somebody working in the trenches. It was mainly worn by engineers, who would be wearing a leather buff coat underneath with this sleeveless armour on top. A siege helmet is very heavy and cumbersome, with a visor to protect the face and a long piece over the back of the neck. There are supports which come out above the wearer's ears and rest on the shoulders. These are intended to spread the impact of a blow should something fall upon the wearer's head. Now head back into the lift and go up to floor 3. We call the next two galleries the world turned upside down. People use the phrase the world turned upside down a lot in 2020, but in fact the phrase comes from the 1640s. It was the title of a ballad intended to protest against some of Parliament's policies. The world really was turned upside down. There were many years of conflict and the chaos caused by that conflict. There were changes in political and religious thinking, spies, radicals, the suffrage movement, and a refugee crisis caused by the fighting. As you go through the door in front of you, there is a wooden box about the height of your knees. This is a Bible box. If you open the box, you can hear a selection of speeches and sermons made by preachers during the 17th century and now voiced by actors. Do you remember Sir Thomas Fairfax, the owner of the wheelchair we saw downstairs, commander of the New Model Army? He also owned the sword and gauntlet that you see above the Bible box here. Gauntlet is an armoured glove for the left hand. It's articulated with many moving parts so that the wearer would still be able to hold the reins of their horse. The sword is long and narrow with a basket hilt, very ornate. But you can see when you look at the blade that there are many signs of damage. This is a well-used sword. Definitely not just for show. To your left, there is a large case in the wall. In the centre of this case, there is a book called Ward's Animadversions of War. This book is like a manual of warfare. Commanding officers could learn the best position for their musketeers, how to form a troop of pikemen, or the best angle from which to shoot a cannon. It is both beautifully and practically illustrated. Going back now to the central case that you saw before, but this time from the other side, there are two objects that I'd like to draw your attention to. Firstly, the scold's bridle, which is on the left side of this case, at about eye height. In 1656, the Quaker, Dorothy Waugh, was moved of the Lord to go to the market of Carlisle to speak against all deceit and ungodly practices. She was dragged off the market cross and brought before the mayor, who put her in a scold's bridle. She wrote that it had 3 bars of iron to put over my face, and a piece of it was put in my mouth, which was so unreasonable big a thing for that place as cannot be well related, which was locked on my head, and so I stood there, with the stone weight of iron upon my head and the bit in my mouth to keep me from speaking, and the mayor said he would make me an example. That describes this scold's bridle very well. It is an iron contraption that's put over the head with a flat piece of metal that goes inside the wearer's mouth. This was designed as a punishment, usually for women. To the right of the scold's bridle is a very tiny object, a small gold ring. It's a posy ring. Posy rings were very popular in the 17th century and were often given as gifts with inscriptions written inside. This one says, "Let no calamity separate amity." We think of this as an early modern friendship ring. Perhaps it was given from one lover to another or from a friend to another to ensure that the warfare did not get in the way of their friendship. On the wall to your left, there is a large version of this ring, which you can touch. It's about the size of a bracelet. Leave this gallery by the door opposite the scold's bridle cross over the staircase landing and into the next gallery. In the staircase, there is a lighting display made of hats. These are many different types of 17th century hat. And this represents the different types of thinking, the new ideas and new opinions that were bubbling around the time of the Civil Wars. The next gallery is called Creativity. It's about some of that new thinking. Walk towards the central display in the middle of this gallery. This is an explosion of print. Many people learnt to read during the Civil Wars, and news travelled fast. There are famous pamphlets, illustrations and books represented here. On the left-hand side of this display, there is our 17th century jukebox. Press the buttons to hear some of the popular songs from the time, including the ballad, The World Turned Upside Down. If you're facing the jukebox, there is a case directly behind you. Turn around now to look in there. In this case, there is a delicate wine glass on the left. This is covered in Jacobite symbols, such as a rose and a butterfly. Then there is a large tankard. We've made a copy of this, which is over to your right, and you can touch this to find the picture on the sides. It's called the Rolleston Chalice, and it represents the return of King Charles II and his marriage to Catherine of Braganza. Also in this case is the Great Seal of the Commonwealth. On one side, it represents the Houses of Parliament, with no king involved at all. On the wall, there is a life mask of Oliver Cromwell's face. We also have made a copy of this, so if you walk now to the table slightly to your right, you'll be able to feel the face of Oliver Cromwell, as well as a copy of the Rolleston Chalice. Leave this room the same way as you came in, back through all of the World Turned Upside Down exhibition, and make your way back to the lift. You're going down to floor one. When you come out of the lift on floor one, you're leaving the British Civil Wars behind you. If you have any other questions about this time in history, please do ask the volunteer who is there to help. Directly across from the lift door is the entrance to the Newark Galleries. These take you on a whistle-stop tour of Newark through the ages. Newark's story begins with Ice Age travellers following the high ground between rivers to stalk their prey. After the ice melted, for centuries, travellers have left their mark and their treasures here. Romans gave us our roads, Vikings named many of our streets. Anglo-Saxons built the castle and the New Work, the town we know as Newark today. Turn to your right to see a large display case. My favourite object in this case is a mammoth tooth. It's about the size of a small loaf of bread, brown and ridged. It was found close to here, so I love to imagine mammoth roaming the Nottinghamshire countryside. Above this is a small selection of hand axes. The one to the left is made of jadeite. The jadeite hand axe is much more likely to have been a status symbol than a real hand tool. It has travelled here from the mountains of Italy. It's smooth and highly polished. It is a sage green colour. Stone Age people used these multi-purpose cutting tools, held in the palm of the hand. If you touch one of these today, sometimes you can still feel the shape of the person's hand as they had developed the tool to fit their own palm. Further to the left in this case is a bone comb. It's an Anglo-Saxon comb. It is shaped in a triangle and decorated with lines, circles and dots inscribed on it. The longest side of this right-angled triangle has been cut into the teeth of the comb. A few teeth are missing, but it's in great condition for its age. Turn to your right and go towards the case against the wall, containing a trophy and a drum. To the right of the drum is a small golden box, a Princess Mary comfort tin. Princess Mary, the 17-year-old daughter of King George V and Queen Mary, decided that the soldiers and sailors of England deserved a Christmas present in 1914. Money was raised by public subscription, and these tins were sent across the world to the soldiers and sailors serving in the First World War. It is an embossed brass tin with a hinged lid, and on the top is a portrait of Princess Mary and underneath the word Christmas 1914. Not all tins had the same contents, Those sent to smokers included a pipe and tobacco. For non-smokers, they received writing paper and a pencil. All of the boxes included a Christmas card from the princess. Indian soldiers received spices and nurses received chocolates. Please watch your step in this room. Because of our COVID secure one-way route in the building, there are some barriers in the middle of this room. Walk back to the case that contained the mammoth tooth and then turn the opposite direction to leave the room by the opposite door. As you walk towards the door, there is a large wooden box to your right, a deed box. You're welcome to touch this if you wish. Cross the hallway to the next Newark gallery and turn to your left. In this case, on the top left, there is a blue smock. It is a knee-length garment with a collar, in the same blue as a pair of jeans. The top half of the smock is highly decorated. There are wavy lines which represent the River Trent and swirls on either side to represent trees. Newark was a major centre for smock making in the 18th and 19th centuries. Cotton was dyed here in mills. Garments were then cut, sewn and smocked by local women, often in their own homes. Many working men would have one smock for daily use and another for their Sunday best. In the same case, over to the right, you'll find an eel spear. In the past, the land around Newark was marshy. Snake-like eels lived in the water. To catch several eels at once, a fisherman would use a spear like this. This spear has five barbed points, shaped like a hand with the fingers outstretched. It would be placed on the end of a long stick. The eel fisherman would stand in his boat and push the spear down into the water at a place where there were many eels all at once. Behind you is a lead coffin containing the complete skeleton of a Roman woman. There was a Roman settlement at Farndon, not far from Newark, and the two Roman roads, the Foss Way and the Great North Road, crossed here. We know these as the A46 and the A1 today. Walking to the end of this gallery, you'll find one of our real star objects. This is the Newark torque. The torque is an Iron Age neck ring, thought to have been worn by somebody from the Iceni tribe. It looks like solid gold, although there are some other metals mixed in there, such as copper. It's heavy. It weighs 700 grams, or 1.5 pounds. The torque is made up of many twisted golden wires, made to form a C shape that goes around the neck. Finished at the front with two small decorative pieces shaped like little donuts. These are hollow and slightly magnetic so that it draws the torque together at the front of the wearer's neck. Making this torque must have been an incredible feat of engineering for something made 2,000 years ago, and it's in excellent condition now, one of the best still existing in Europe. It was deliberately buried underground and was found by a metal detectorist a few years ago. What an incredible find. Walk now towards the case on your right. In the centre of this case are three tiny little lead soldiers. They are wearing black trousers and a red soldier's coat with a bearskin hat, the tall fur cap still worn by grenadier guards today. Two of the soldiers are standing, holding their guns, and the third is lying on his stomach, ready to shoot. To the right of this case is a huge wooden printing press. The poet Lord Byron lived with his mother in Southwell when he was a teenager. His first two volumes of poetry were printed here in Newark, on this very press. Please touch the press if you like. Next to the press is a spinning wheel from Newark's first girls' school, the Jersey School. Above this is a beautiful oil painting, a portrait of a woman. She has dark hair, which is covered by a veil and a headpiece made of star-shaped metal pieces and feathers. She is wearing a dark dress and holding a fan. This is Lady Ossington. Lady Ossington is known locally as the person who had built the Ossington Coffee Palace. It is opposite Newark Castle by the bridge. The Coffee Palace was a place for travellers to rest, to play billiards, to drink coffee, to relax and read, without serving alcohol, as she was a fan of the temperance movement. Positioned at the side of the Great North Road, it was a bit like the service stations that we use today. When you have finished exploring the Newark Galleries, return to the lift area the same way that you came in. I hope that you've enjoyed listening to this audio-described guide of the National Civil War Centre and Newark Museum. If you have any suggestions to make of how we can make this better for future visitors, please do let us know. Thank you.